Welcome to the Missing Chapter podcast, where you will hear some of the least known, obscure, and entertaining stories the history textbooks left out, starring Phil Horander and Phil Schauff.
I think everyone would agree with me when I say that we'd all like to be better stewards of our money. Maybe we didn't need that $6 latte this past Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and, okay, Thursday and Friday. I mean, my goodness, that's $30 a week in caffeinated beverages. Who would ever do that? Certainly not your caffeine-addicted coffee aficionados known as the Phils. But in all honesty, just like anything in life, a little over a lot of time, it adds up to a lot. Someone resisting that latte every week can save upwards of $1,500 a year. My goodness, what would that equate to if you invested that in a long-term portfolio earning compounded interest? That's a nice little retirement right there. But what if you could get that kind of 30-year investment, say, in 2 or 3 years turnaround? That kind of investment, does that even exist? Well, they kind of do, and they kind of don't simultaneously. What the heck am I talking about? Well, grab a coffee or your $6 latte and let's write another missing chapter.
Welcome to the Missing Chapter podcast. You are here with Phil Horander and Phil Schauff. Phil, today's coffee of choice is Dunkin' Donuts' very own Turtle Love, which got me thinking.
Yeah.
All right. And I didn't ask you this before we went on the air. Turtle Love, I mean, turtles are cookies. And here we are in March. We're recording this episode. It's got me thinking about Girl Scout cookies. Do you have a favorite Girl Scout cookie?
Okay. So we went to Lowe's the other day, and there's the Girl Scout selling Girl Scout cookies.
They know. What a smart setup.
So let's say you're in a rush, and you don't want to disrespect these beautiful little girls, right?
Yes.
So what do you say to them when you're on a rush and rushing your way out?
I would say I don't have cash.
Well, what do they have now? They have Venmo.
This is Girl Scouts of 2024 Venmoing.
So we stopped. I love the Samoas. I'm not a huge coconut fan, but for whatever reason, man, they are so good. My wife is a big Thin Mints.
That's where I'm going.
What's the tagalongs? Those girls love that.
You really can't go wrong with any of them, but I think Thin Mints, we put them in the freezer.
Oh, that's great.
And then
we take
them out and they're really cold. They're really good. But I like the Samoas too. I'm with you on that one.
What about the new one? Have you had the new one yet? The brownie caramel cookie goodness?
Oh, I have not.
I'm a big fan. Everyone else in my household didn't really care for it.
Okay.
So.
Hey, to each their own.
Yeah, sure.
To each their own. Sure. You know, it's kind of like, hey, everybody's got their favorite episode of the Missing Chapter podcast, right?
That's true.
So, I mean, your favorite episode might not be someone else's favorite episode.
Your cup of tea is a little bit different.
That's right. But
we don't drink tea in this podcast.
No, anyway. We don't.
All right.
No,
sorry.
We don't drink tea.
Sorry.
Maybe an occasional hot chocolate. But when it comes to telling stories and talking history, it's coffee time.
Good, because when we clicked record, I was sipping my last sip of the coffee that we had today, the Turtle Love, and I was like chugging it because it's so good.
It is really good. We went through a full pot, and it's a little after 9.
Yeah.
So we were just talking about how we're going to have to brew a second pot,
I think
to get us through the day. So, yeah. Phil, what do you got on tap for us today?
All right, so in the intro, we talked about this. I mean, my goodness, what kind of investment is this, right? So you have this big turnaround in maybe 2 or 3 years, maybe even shorter, double your money possibly. That's insane. Well, here it goes, and let's just go right after it. From Time Magazine, because they do a really good job of describing this story that I have for you today. The person who created this investment, all right, this little idea, found a little loophole that he said could make people a ton of money. He will take advantage of fluctuating currency values to purchase international postal reply coupons. That's another thing. Here's a question. Do you say coupon or coupon?
Coupon.
Coupon? Sure.
Coup.
Yeah. I think coup I was.
D'etat. Coupon.
I was originally the coupon. And then I don't know, one day I was like, that doesn't sound right. I'm going to go back to coupon. All right. Anyway, tomato, tomato. So anyway, so to give you an idea, the way Time Magazine described it, it's kind of complicated, so let me simplify it for you. Postage vouchers that senders of a letter from one country could include this type of voucher to encourage a reply from a recipient from another country. Mm. Okay. So I would send you a letter in England, and I would include a voucher within the envelope. So okay. It would encourage your reply. Very similar to when someone sends us a bill, you know, like, oh, you went to right. the urgent care, and here's a self, you know, an envelope with it already posted.
It's convenient. So you're more likely to get a response. That
right.
makes sense.
So he found this loophole, this guy, and he claimed that he could purchase the coupons abroad at a discount, but then sell them at face value in the United States at a tremendous profit.
Hmm.
Okay. So we somehow discovered this loophole, and it makes sense. So how is this possible? Well, he refused to provide details as to precisely how he operated this investment strategy, but he claimed that he didn't want to give it away because he would give his information to his competitors, which I can understand to a certain degree. So, you know what's funny? We're all over the places. Where, you know what I immediately just thought of?
What's that?
Remember the part in Dumb and Dumber where Jim Carrey's like, "We'll cheat up and we'll tell you." It's kind of like that situation, you know, like we're... How did you do this? How did you have this such a great investment strategy? Well, why don't you buy in and then we'll tell you? It doesn't work like
doesn't
that.
Doesn't work
you
know like that, Phil.
Yeah, sorry to go off the rails there with a little Dumb and Dumber reference. But I think
whenever you're inspired, Phil, especially when it comes to a Jim Carrey movie, okay. feel free to go off script here a little bit. I like it.
All right. So all in all, you're probably thinking it sounds a little hairy, maybe,
mm-hmm.
But it also has, I don't know, some sort of promise to it because it somewhat makes sense.
Right.
So let me just give you the guy's name so you can start investing. How about that?
Sure.
Okay.
Let's All do
right.
it.
So just look up a guy by the name of Charles Ponzi.
Come on. How can you not love this podcast? I mean, are you driving right now? Are you sitting at home? Did anyone see that coming? Come on. This is something you're going to share with a friend at least today. You've heard it.
But for the love of God, don't email Charles Ponzi.
No, don't email Charles Ponzi. But, like, you know, that's a perfect segue, Phil.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Yeah. Well, anyway.
All right.
At its essence, a Ponzi scheme involves a phony investment in which early investors are paid with the investments of later investors, making the enterprise appear legitimate. So Ponzi schemes, also known as pyramid schemes, often appear complicated on the surface, and Charles Ponzi's fraud was no different. So Charles Ponzi, who is he? Well, he's an Italian immigrant, made a fortune off of lying to people.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. In fact, he was so good at deception that the government named a type of fraud after him, of course, we know as the Ponzi scheme. In 1920, Ponzi tricked thousands of New England residents in investing in that very postage stamp speculation scheme that we started with. So more specifically, let's talk here. He promised investors that he could provide a whopping 50% return in 90 days. I mean, seriously, though, in the early 1900s, you know, with the fluctuation of the markets, to pull this off is pretty remarkable, right?
Well, and I think of initially, like, all right, you know, growing up in a time period of spam emails and, you know, calls on your cell phone where you know you're trying to be manipulated.
Right.
This didn't exist.
Yeah.
This was new. And people, I think, were good-natured and tended to believe that people were being honest with them.
Correct.
So, I mean, he's playing off of the idea that no one had done this before and that people want to believe you.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's new. So for people listening at home, it's like, well, how can you fall for this maybe? It's like, well...
Because we fall for it all the time,
we fall
right?
for it all the time in 2024, but this is before any of that took place.
I was on the phone with AT&T for the longest time a few months ago
mm-hmm.
because DirecTV was bought by AT&T.
Right.
So I'm like, listen, I got this email. It says it's going to credits. My credit card didn't go through. And she's like, read the email back to me. I said, it says AT&T. She goes, No, click on the email itself. I clicked it. And it was some wonky Gmail account from overseas. And they're getting very, very good to the point where... Even if someone's calling you, your phone will display somebody that you actually know.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
which
right
is unbelievable.
It used to be, hey, they're using the same area code. That's creative. But now they're actually mimicking people, I think, in your contact.
Yes.
List.
And
they're good.
I had my own phone number call me not too long ago. I'm like, wait, that's my phone number. It can't be it. But anyway, now my dad listens to this. My mom and dad listen to this. My dad picks up the spam phone calls all the time just to mess with them.
Yeah, but now it's animated.
That's
it
true.
It used to be a real person that you could have some fun with. I told you I used to have Andrew answer them.
Yeah.
But now it's just, I don't know. It's not even a real person.
So you're just messing with a robot?
Yeah.
Just messing with AI?
That's not very fun. Yeah. No.
That one time that someone asked me if I could have if they could give me my social security number to look up the
sure.
credit,
you know,
the credit
department. Social security number, have it.
I could hear the PA of a mall that they were in, no joke. And I'm like, wait, what mall are you at? And they hung up on me.
Yeah.
Anyway, I digress. So to put this in perspective here, let's map this out here. To make this work, each time a new investor would give Ponzi money, he would use those funds to pay off earlier investors. So he created this illusion that they were profiting from a legitimate business. And often they were coached to recruit more investors to enrich themselves further, the whole essence of a pyramid. The problem is that there's no actual investment going on. The only activity is this kind of shuffling of money from new investors to the old ones. And everything is fine until the scheme runs out of new investors and the whole house of cards comes tumbling down. But from all appearances, Ponzi was a man of his word. Early investors were rewarded very well, I might add, and it appears that his work is unbelievably successful and the word spreads. People began begging him for his services. And after I read this from Time, this is the moment where I really, really cringed. And I actually stopped and I remember just having this moment, like pausing. And I said, my God, deception is really clever, right? The people were so deceived that they begged for their own demise.
Yeah, that's deep. And, right. and I'm thinking, too, how smart he was in the fact that the initial people he worked with were not manipulated.
Right.
He was smart because if you manipulate right off the bat, word's going to get out quickly that this
Absolutely.
Is a scheme and it's not true. Whereas rather, he initially people got returns.
Yes.
And that just kind of, it drives him forward with the schemes he'll be pulling later
Correct.
On. That's smart.
It's spot on. And we talk about this with our kids, with our government classes as seniors. We talk a lot of politics and those kind of things. And I think one of the things we touched on just a few weeks ago is that the deeper the deception, the more subtle. You know, and this is one of those moments. If it, like you said, if it was in everybody's face, they're like, that's a scheme, man.
Right,
I'm not
going
to do that.
No.
But the deeper the deception, the more subtle the deception itself mm-hmm. and the subtle the tactics. So the math, though, if you just kind of pan it out, it just doesn't work. So behind the scenes, Ponzi was able to pay his investors using money from new investors, but they weren't the profits.
Mm-hmm.
So Ponzi was brought down due to a series of investigative reports in the Boston Post newspaper, which ultimately led to a federal criminal investigation, which resulted in, of course, the mail fraud charges. So doing some research here, the Ponzi scheme, a lot of these Ponzi schemes altogether share some common characteristics. The high visibility, the very popular nature of their apparently lucrative investments made them appear legitimate. And a lot of Ponzi schemers, and you mentioned this too, Phil, also appear to be terribly selective. And I love the wording of that. And who is allowed to invest with them. Criminals exploit a rampant fear of missing out on a golden opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea of FOMO, fear of missing out, you just touched upon that. Like you're tapping into something innate within a human being. You don't want to miss out on an opportunity. You feel like, and the criminals recognize that and see that. The fraudulent deceptors take hold of that nature and profit off of it.
And I also feel like it puts them in a position where they have to make a decision quickly.
Yes.
Don't sit and think about it, because if you do that, you're going to start to see maybe some holes in what I'm telling
That's
you.
Right.
Whereas rather, there's a time frame, and if you don't act now, you'll miss out. And people, you're right. You're playing off of human nature where you don't want to miss out. Let's go ahead and do it. Knee-jerk reactions.
That's exactly right. Alan Greenspan, former Federal Reserve chairman, said that a common theme among Ponzi scheme victims is, quote, irrational exuberance, a term popularized by whereby people observe others making great profits from investments and determine that this means the investments are safe, even if there's no underlying reason to support those conclusions. He said irrational exuberance is nothing new and certainly was applicable as far back as the tulip mania of the 1600s in the Netherlands, when speculation in investments in tulip bulbs led to a dramatic market crash in 1637. So you have this innate desire to, you know, have this just joy in saying, I think I found, you know, something that could make us a lot of money. But in totality, here we go. At the height of this huge Ponzi scheme and this scam, he raked in $250,000 a day, which is about $3 million in today's money. But his days of scheming and scamming caught up to him in August of 1920, when he was charged with 86 counts of mail fraud.
Wow.
Yeah. So what have we learned since this Ponzi scheme and since he was arrested about 100 years ago? Pretty much seemingly little, because last year the U.S. law enforcement discovered 60 major Ponzi schemes with victims investing $3.25 billion in these totally fraudulent scams.
Welcome back from the break. You're here with the Missing Chapter podcast, Phil Horner and Phil Shaw. Phil, we did it again, and I think we did it unknowingly. We mentioned Jim Carrey movies, and ironically enough, there's a Jim Carrey movie where he gets caught up kind of not, he's not doing it intentionally, but he gets caught up in a Ponzi scheme. I think it was with Tay Leone. It was Fun with Dick and Jane. So that's the sort of thing that runs through my mind as I'm listening to you do your story today. But there is a Jim Carrey movie that involves a Ponzi scheme.
And all I can picture is him yelling, indicted, indicted. Yeah. It's funny because we think, and our wives will certainly back us up on this. We think in movie quotes.
Right. And I used to think everyone did. And Aaron has informed me they don't. They don't. But she'll say to me, listen, Phil's not here. No one knows what you're talking about. That's a direct quote from my wife. But I had to throw that out there. I'm sure somebody else made that connection.
Totally.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah. That's a very unknown Jim Carrey movie, too.
Yes.
I thought it was great. I thought it was hilarious.
It was good.
But it's not, you know, on the same level as a Dumb and Dumber.
Right.
Or The
Mask.
That
goes without saying. But Phil, you laid out a very, very interesting, like, you know, where does the term come from? I had no idea it was connected with someone's last name, you know, that the actual act of doing this was his last name. So, I mean, the story was interesting. I love when we tie in, you know, verbiage and terminology and kind of explain the backstory to that, which I feel like you did in the first half of this.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
So I think part of that history, though, is if you don't understand it, there's no way you're going to be able to explain it to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the best way to share history, is to really explain and get into detail. What's interesting is there's a level to this that was a little bit deeper than I had anticipated. The notoriety of Charles Ponzi, of course, because of the word Ponzi scheme that carries his name, but it appears that it was first carried out by a girl by the name of Sarah Howe in Boston of 1879.
Hmm.
So it could be where he got the idea from. There's no confirmation of that.
And no connection between the two?
No connection.
Maybe he heard about it, but there's
maybe
no connection.
Okay. No. She created what she called the ladies' deposit to help invest money for women. Now, according to the famed economist John Kenneth Galbraith, the man who is admired for the ingenuity of his larceny is almost always rediscovering some earlier form of fraud.
Hmm.
And it seems to be the case with Ponzi. But Sarah Howe's promises of profits were pretty astounding. Promises of investors' funds would be doubling in mere 9 months, she gave. So once again, it was journalists who exposed that, investigated, and discovered her scam. She's eventually charged, convicted of her crimes. She ended up serving 3 years in prison, actually.
Wow.
Yeah. She managed to perpetuate an identical scam, actually, from the original for 2 years before getting caught yet again. So there's an ongoing belief that, you know, once one Ponzi scheme starts, another copycat. And it kind of seems that is what happened here. Although, as I said, there's no real confirmation of that. So what happened to Ponzi? From the Smithsonian.com, Ponzi himself, probably inspired by her and maybe even the remarkable success of William, quote, 520% Miller, who was a young Brooklyn bookkeeper who in 1899 coerced gullible investors to the tune of more than $1 million in the 19th century. That's a lot of money. So years later, Honest Bill, as he became to be known after a jail term in Sing Sing, turned down the straight and narrow and questioned the wrong workings of Ponzi's enterprise. All right. So he was the one that says, hey, listen, I think I know what's going on here. And this was all before he was tried. But, quote, I may be rather dense, but I cannot understand how Ponzi made so much money in so short a time, Miller said. So it kind of tells you that, listen, as maybe copycat-ish as Ponzi was,
right,
still pretty brilliant to turn out this deception.
Yeah, I mean, you have to convince and fool a lot of people.
Yeah.
It, you know, you think if if you had taken that ability and actually put it into a legitimate business, would you have had the same success?
That's a great point. Yeah. So what ended up happening to Ponzi? His money ran out, and he decided the wisest course of action was to head west. So on November 15th, 1903, he stepped off the gangplank of the SS Vancouver in Boston Harbor with only a couple of dollars in his pocket, which was the result, he said, of being taken in by a card sharp during the transatlantic crossing. Quote, "I landed in this country with $2.50 in cash and $1 million in hopes, and those hopes never left me," Ponzi later told the New York Times. But it says the road to riches was a long one for the ever optimistic Ponzi, who waited, and bussed tables in New York City, painted signs in Florida, and worked small jobs up and down the East Coast. But then in 1917, he headed back to Boston in response to a newspaper ad placed by merchandise broker J.R. Poole, who needed a clerk. Now, there's more to this story. He soon met a young Rose Necco on a streetcar and wooed her. Okay, small, pretty woman from modest background, Rose was swept off her feet by this older, seemingly sophisticated gentleman, and they end up marrying in February of 1918. Now, I guess old dog, new tricks kind of thing. Here we are. Ponzi took over his father-in-law's grocery business. I don't know if that would be the proper choice on that regard. He proceeded to make a mess of it.
Oh, boy.
So he had already left his wife, Poole, who apparently failed to recognize his new clerk's latent financial genius. So once a crook, always a crook, I guess you could say. So I think all in all, Phil, as we close here, it's one of those situations where as we started this episode, we're going to end this episode. Be careful of the subtle deception, right? Try to be aware of those things and maybe just invest in something that's wholesome and good.
Right.
Thank you for joining us, and until next time,
I'm Phil Horinder,
and I'm Phil Schaff. Another chapter has been added to the history textbooks.